This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a longtime Milwaukee reporter about her story of grief and single motherhood after the sudden death of her husband and how she learned to grow through the trauma. Now, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky paid a surprise visit to the U.S. Capitol yesterday, meeting earlier in the day with President Joe Biden at the White House and addressing a joint meeting of Congress in the evening.
We have artillery. Yes. Thank you. We have it. Is it enough? Honestly, not really.
Zelensky came directly from a combat zone in Ukraine on Tuesday. During his visit, continued to wear wartime clothing, an army green sweatshirt, cargo pants, and combat boots. We're looking at the timing of his visit, what he hoped to accomplish, and where the war to get Russia out of Ukraine goes from here. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions, what reactions do you have to Zelensky's visit? What do you want to know about U.S. support for Ukraine, past, present, and future? What do you want to see the U.S. do to support Ukraine? Do you think there's been enough? Do you want to see more? What questions do you have about how this all ends? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lowell Barrington is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. Lowell, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. It's great to be with you again.
Can you talk about why this visit and why now?
Well, I think it was interesting because there was not a lot of advance warning, as you know. It came together pretty quickly, sort of over the weekend with some planning, and then was really only announced right before Zelensky was in D.C. And I think there are a few things with the timing. I think one was there has been a little bit in Europe, but also a bit in the United States of some kind of rumblings in the political system from different people about maybe we, you know, need to cut back a bit on the aid to Ukraine and we got to focus on ourselves a bit. And as much as he's been very effective in the past with these addresses where he's speaking virtually, you just can't, you know, replace being in person. And I think it was a at times powerful and a very effective speech where he made the case for further aid. And I think made it much more difficult for people who were kind of calling that into question to continue with their positions.
Can you talk about some of his specific asks to the president and to Congress and how they match up with the current situation on the battlefield in Ukraine?
Well, I mean, first of all, I will say we've given a lot of aid to Ukraine. We've given not just military aid. There's been a lot of non-military aid. I think people don't pay enough attention to a lot of humanitarian and financial aid, and Ukraine still needs that. And I think in some of the meetings that were going on with advisors on both sides, I think that was still continued to be talked about. But there's been a real shift over the course of this war about the kinds of weapons Ukraine needs. Initially, we've talked about in the past, the sort of smaller weapons. We've sent over 10,000 total javelins and stingers to Ukraine. Those were really effective early on, but as the summer dragged into the fall, they just were less necessary. We needed Ukraine to have longer range sort of, you know, battlefield munitions and things. That's when we started talking about the HIMARS system, which has been talked about in the past. And I think the big change for where we are today is really starting in October. You know, Russia just massively stepped up this launching of rockets and missiles at cities in Ukraine, often targeting the energy grid. I think it took some people a little while to realize, even though a lot of us were saying early on that seems to be the target, you know, kind of took a little bit for some people to realize it was not really going after civilians as much as going after them indirectly by going after the energy grid. So this has led to Ukraine wanting an increased ability to try to intercept those rockets and missiles, and increasingly worried about these Iranian-made drones, which have been very effective as well for Russia.
And President Zelensky made the case that, yes, this is help for Ukraine, but it's bigger than that. Here's a listen.
Your money is not charity. It's an investment in the global security and democracy that we handle in the most responsible way.
Can you talk about that? Something at stake even bigger, and it's still important, even bigger than the survival of Ukraine and Ukrainian people, that this has consequences for the United States.
Yeah, I thought he's very smart in really not only kind of leading them with that, but continuing to come back to it in the speech. That this was really, he said at one point, this sort of a broader fight, you know, for freedom over tyranny. This isn't just a, as you said, Ukraine-Russia conflict. The other thing about that in terms of some political context is earlier this week, Mitch McConnell said something actually quite similar, which was interesting, where he basically said, you know, there's a kind of moral argument for this, but there's also just a really, you know, nuts and bolts American national security interest reason for doing this as well. And I think that the Zelensky speech sort of went beyond that, but it also built on that idea that this is in our interest too. It's not just something we're doing, as Zelensky said, out of a sense of charity.
We are talking to Lowell Barrington from Marquette University about Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's visit to Washington, D.C. tomorrow, address to both chambers of Congress, and the latest in the Russian invasion of Ukraine. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, what you want to see from U.S. policy there, your questions about what's going on in the war, what it would take to end it. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Lowell, you mentioned the targeting of power plants. Very wintry here in Wisconsin now. The same in Ukraine. Here is President Zelensky talking about the impact of that and Ukrainian resolve.
In 2 days, we will celebrate Christmas. Maybe candlelit. Not because it's more romantic, no, but because there will be no electricity. Millions won't have neither heating nor running water. All of these will be the result of Russian missile and drone attacks on our energy infrastructure. But we do not complain. We do not judge and compare whose life is easier. Your well-being is the product of your national security, the result of your struggle for independence and your many victories. We, Ukrainians, will also go through our war of independence and freedom with dignity and success.
Lowell, he's speaking to Ukrainian resolve there under incredibly difficult conditions. You actually conducted surveys of people in Ukraine just a couple months back. Did what you find matched up with what the president of Ukraine was suggesting there?
Yeah, it did. We actually had a few things that we were kind of expecting, but I think I was still surprised at the strength of the unity of the Ukrainian population in a few ways. And we asked both, you know, sort of closed-ended questions where they had to choose among some responses, but also allowed them to just speak openly and freely in their own words. And those were really powerful things that they said about how, you know, this, they see this as a fight for the survival of their nation, for their own identity. And when when a war is ultimately about identity, it allows the side that has been attacked to, you know, be more effective in its mobilization. It is really seen by a lot of Ukrainians as, you know, this is not just about our territorial control. It's about our very lives and the survival of the Ukrainian identity.
We've seen some outsiders from around the world say, okay, if we want peace, it might require some territorial concessions from Ukraine. Crimea, parts of the Donetsk region that had been effectively controlled by Russia in some ways, even before the invasion. You asked specifically about that in surveys. What did Ukrainians say?
We did, and these were some of the most stunning responses. We asked a couple different versions of the same question, sort of asked them with opposite wording. So if you're answering consistently, you know, you would strongly agree with one and strongly disagree with the other. And that's what happened. They were consistent, they were unified, and it was in the range of 90 to 95% of the Ukrainian people basically held this position that there will be no territorial concessions, that the only acceptable outcome is a complete victory that involves Russian withdrawal from all territory of Ukraine, including Crimea, which again is a really, really strong position to take. And what's interesting is in some ways that gives Zelensky a little bit of leverage in his negotiations with Russia. He doesn't have the situation where he can say, my people are open to compromise here. On the other hand, again, it's a limiting thing, right? It constrains what he can do politically within his own country. I think he's been, you know, masterful in his execution of the army offensives and defensive actions that have been taken from a military standpoint, but also just incredibly successful at mobilizing and rallying his people. And I think he's in a way a victim of his own success there, that he has made people believe that Ukraine can win this war. And as a result, they are not going to, easily accept territorial concessions to Russia at this point.
Well, staying on the idea of Ukraine giving up territory, the notion that, okay, if Ukraine gave up Crimea, some of its eastern part to Putin, and then Putin would say, okay, I'm happy now. I have all the land I want for Russia. I mean, that seems naive to think that, given the pretext he's given for invading Ukraine could apply to other parts of the former Soviet Union or other parts of the Russian Empire. That doesn't really sound like a road to lasting peace to me.
I think that's a fair point. I think we think back to the beginning of the war and the way he talked about this and why the initial attack was on Kyiv, which was about removing what Putin called a Nazi government. There was this theme of denazification of Ukraine. And so I don't know if he would be satisfied. I think at this point he would, in the short run, take that as a victory that he could point to with his own people. But he also has his own constraints that again are somewhat of his own doing, which is he has really kind of leaned on and unleashed Russian nationalism. And the Russian nationalists are if anything, quite critical of this war from it not being aggressive enough in how it's been approached so far. And so again, it would be interesting for him to have to sell, really only getting what they already had after 2014, after all this, right, which would be Crimea and that eastern part of Donetsk and Luhansk. It would seem like he has to offer the Russian people something more than that as well. So both presidents are really in a difficult situation where there's not an overlap in what they can probably effectively pitch to their own people as a win from at least a territorial control standpoint.
We're talking about Ukrainian President Zelensky's surprise visit to Washington, D.C. yesterday and the current state of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Our guest is Marquette University political science professor Lowell Barrington, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you watch that address to Congress last night? What did you think? What do you want to see come out of this? Do you see a path to peace? Do you have questions for our guest about what's going on in U.S. policy there? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Lowell Barrington, associate professor of political science at Marquette University, looking at the state of the war in Ukraine and President Zelensky's visit to Washington yesterday. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your comments, your questions for our guest. Let's bring on a caller now. Charlie is with us in Beaver Dam. Charlie, hi.
I don't know who I heard it from. It was probably on yours or WPR, but I heard that there's rare metal earths in the eastern part of Ukraine, and that is what the main reason for the attack is. They want the land for the rare metal earths. And I also heard that Afghanistan, Russia was there 12 years before we were, and I was told from someone that was stationed over there that they have the largest deposits of lithium left in the world,
Charlie,
in Ukraine.
Thanks. I gotcha. Thanks for the call, Charlie. Lowell, is this in part a resource war on Russia's part?
It is. I mean, I will say I've heard less of that narrow kind of sense of the resources in question, but there is certainly a view of eastern Ukraine as having more of the kind of industrial economic base of Ukraine initially, although again, there's been an awful lot of destruction as a result of the war, so there will have to be a lot of repair and efforts to rebuild Ukraine after the war, regardless of which country is controlling that area. There's also a lot of agricultural production in the eastern part of Ukraine. I think we think of the western part of Ukraine as the more agricultural area, but what's called the kind of black earth, the really rich soil areas of Ukraine include a lot of the east as well. So I think there were some economic calculations. Ultimately, this war has been in a lot of ways about identity from the start, and that's also on the Russian side. I think on the list of things that Putin does really deeply believe, I think that he believes to some extent that Russians and Ukrainians are one people, as he's said and written about. And I think that he felt like this was an area that Russia really just had a right to historically and today.
Charlie. Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Lowell, in a memo you sent out with your survey results from Ukraine, you talk about some of the conditions for peaceful resolution of conflict. You mentioned an overlap in negotiating positions between the two parties. That doesn't seem to be in place here. One side winning a decisive war militarily and making the other side retreat and give up. That seems like a tall order for either side. What could be a path to a peaceful resolution here?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think one thing we do need to also think about is the role of the Western alliance in all this and to what extent they remain solid in their support of Ukraine. That while it does mean the war is prolonged, it also means Ukraine doesn't have to as easily think about making concessions because they are getting support. Ultimately, in a lot of ways, I think we can't expect a diplomatic solution anytime soon. I think if Putin were to be removed or were to die in one way or another in office or something like that, maybe the door would be open. But again, as we've talked about in the past, I think that the danger there is we don't know what we're going to get after Putin and Russia either. And it could be someone who's actually even more of a Russian nationalist than Putin seems to be a lot of the time. So I'm not optimistic. I think Putin's strategy in all this is literally to sort of starve and freeze Ukrainians this winter and force them to negotiate. That is why they're going after the electrical grid and water supplies and things like that with these missile strikes. And I think as much as we're dealing with a weather situation here that's a real serious thing, and it's in the 30s in Ukraine. It's warmer there than here right now, but they are dealing with not these just kind of regularly scheduled rolling blackouts. They're losing electricity and heating for sometimes days at a time as the winter is about to get worse and worse. So I think that Putin believes that strategy has a chance to work. I don't think that's right. I think as Zelensky has made clear, the Ukrainian resolve is not going to be broken by those kinds of actions.
And staying with the humanitarian impact, you were just talking about, of course, people going out without water, without electricity. We've also seen dire consequences when territory and when people fall into Russian hands there. What do we know about war crimes, atrocities, people throwing around the word genocide?
That's not only being exposed as Ukraine has grabbed more territory back from Russia in the conflict, where they've taken towns and have been able to actually locate and find these mass graves in some of the cities from territory they've reclaimed. But there's also been good work done on using satellite photos and different things around cities that Russians are in control of, and seeing the digging of huge trenches and mass graves and then filling them back over that people have been cataloging as well. I will say I don't want to portray this as one side is the only evil side and the other side's just doing everything perfectly well. I'm sure we will discover that Ukraine at times took actions in the heat of the battle that we would not want to have been them doing as well. But it is, as a whole, it's been a largely one-sided thing in that regard. And I think we're going to continue to find that after the war. This will be a kind of horrific part of history for this part of the world for decades down the road in terms of the slow rollout of what people will find year after year.
Talking to Lowell Barrington from Marquette University with the latest on the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the Ukrainian president's visit to Washington, D.C. yesterday. Lowell, in response to that visit, we've seen statements from spokespeople for the Kremlin, the Putin administration, saying that this is a proxy war for the U.S., U.S. being willing to sacrifice Ukrainians, and saying it won't deter Russia from meeting its goals in Ukraine. What can we tell are the Russian goals in Ukraine at this point in the war?
That's a really, really good question, because, again, I think they've been changing. There is a sense in the short term right now that what Russia is doing is largely giving up on some of the areas in the south. So the area that Ukraine got back around Kherson, I think they are not trying to take, but they are trying to push more through Donetsk and Luhansk than they have control of right now. Actually, Zelensky mentioned in his speech this this area of Bakhmut in eastern Ukraine, and that's pretty far northeast into the Donetsk region. So this is an area that Ukraine has held on to, and I think again they are really looking for that in terms of Russia as an area to get control of, just from a kind of public relations victory standpoint. I think the other thing that they are trying to do in some ways is to get wins by taking out Ukrainian equipment when they can. And I will say that one of the things that a lot of people are focusing on is this decision to send a Patriot missile battery to Ukraine. And I do think it's, again, it was kind of a PR victory for Zelensky, but it will also be a very high priority target for the Russian military when that is up and running.
Lowell, what are you watching for in the next few weeks?
Well, domestically here, I think one of the things we're looking at is whether what we've seen in the U.S. Senate and in the bulk of the House of Representatives stays in place when the House switches over to Republican control in terms of the attitudes about aid. I will say I've been kind of frustrated with the rhetoric about the, we're not going to have a blank check for Ukraine. I think that's a really false kind of red herring type statement in the first place, that there's never been a blank check. We've always had to argue for and make a case for, as the American government, to others in the government and to the American people, about what we're doing in Ukraine. So I think that, that's one thing, though, that we will have to watch, is just to what extent there will be pressure to kind of cut back on support for Ukraine. And then I guess, again, in a not very uplifting way, I mean, I think the biggest thing to watch is just how the Ukrainians do survive and hang in there through this next weeks and months as the weather gets worse and worse and the missile and rocket strikes continue.
Lowell, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Lowell Barrington, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University, with us to look at the war in Ukraine and break down what we heard from President Volodymyr Zelensky during a surprise visit to Washington, D.C. yesterday. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, school nurses are often at the front lines when it comes to spotting illness outbreaks among students and for treating those everyday bumps and bruises along the way, but there aren't enough of those nurses to go around, it looks like. Find out why some school leaders, some school districts are facing a nurse shortage and possible solutions. You can join in and tell us what you see in your own local school. That's coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show. Yesterday on the show, we talked about made-for-TV holiday movies. Here's a story about another movie that's become a Christmas classic on television, but only because of copyright law. It's a Wonderful Life is a standby movie to watch this time of year. A lot of people see it as the Christmas movie. But as reported in the Wall Street Journal, the movie was a flop when it was released in 1946. It was such a failure that when the copyright was set to be renewed 28 years later, nobody bothered. So It's a Wonderful Life entered the public domain in 1974, which meant that, hey, if you own a TV station or later a cable network, you could fill a couple hours for free by showing this forgotten film. Well, as we know now, it didn't stay forgotten for long. This couldn't happen today. Copyright laws have been changed. Movies stay copyrighted for 95 years. And in the 90s, the U.S. Supreme Court retroactively changed the rules to bring back some copyrights for It's a Wonderful Life. So the rebirth of It's a Wonderful Life will be a unique Christmas movie miracle. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, when longtime Milwaukee journalist Gail Garbarino Cullen's husband Steve was just 40, he died unexpectedly. In the course of just a few hours, Cullen was left alone to parent their four young children. We're talking today about her experience of grief and sudden single parenthood, what she learned, how she got through it, and how it shaped her as a person, and lessons she hopes to share with others. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. We want to hear about your expressions of grief, sudden loss, and single parenthood. What was grief like for you? What was the hardest part? What helped you get through it? What advice would you have for people who are newly grieving? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Gail Garbarino-Cullen is a longtime TV and radio reporter in Milwaukee. She's the author of the book Owning Grief, Widowed Young, How I Discovered Gifts in Loss. Gail, thanks for joining us today.
I'm really pleased to be here, Rob. Thanks for having me.
I understand you started to write this book because you were looking for a book like this and it wasn't out there for you. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, I mean, I was young. I was 41 years old and I had these four little girls and all of a sudden my husband was snatched away from our lives and I was really looking for something to read. I'm a big reader and something that could give me a sense of direction or some idea of what lay ahead. And I really was struggling to find anything. There's a lot of books about grief and a lot of, you know, meditations and things like that, but I really wasn't finding anything that specifically related to my circumstance as a young widow and a newly single mother. And so I kind of said to myself at the time, when I have time, which would be a little ways down the road, that I was going to write such a book. And that's what Owning Grief has become.
And your story is, I think, any married person and parent's nightmare. Can you talk about your unexpected loss of Steve?
Sure. Steve was 40 years old and a pretty healthy individual. I mean, we ate our share of pizza and other not so healthy foods, but for the most part, a pretty healthy guy. He was a runner. He had done many marathons and, in fact, had run a marathon just 3 days before he died. And then, you know, he was away on a business trip and was supposed to pick up my youngest daughter on a given day after school, and I would pick up the other kids, and he didn't show up. And he was due back from his business trip, and I was kind of curious. And bottom line was, after many phone calls, I discovered that he had been found dead in his hotel room. And the ultimate autopsy couldn't really tell me definitively, but their best guess is that it was a sudden cardiac arrhythmia, essentially like a switch that flipped and his heart just quit.
And now your life, of course, you're dealing with the grief from the loss of Steve. You're raising four kids, doing all the stuff that goes into that, but by yourself now. So you're figuring that out and you're dealing with your kids' grief. These are young kids. I don't know how you did it. Can you talk just a little bit about how overwhelming that must have been?
Yeah, well, the kids were ages 3 to 9, so very little. And even trying to get them to understand that their dad wasn't coming home and why that was challenging, to say the least. And then, as you said, dealing with their grief as well as my own and still trying to put one foot in front of the other and get them back on track as far as school and soccer and life, while still trying to deal with my own grief and my own loss and the enormous responsibility that every parent feels of trying to raise your kids. And then suddenly having that responsibility quadrupled, I think, because I was now doing it absolutely alone without my life's partner. So it was huge. And it was a daily thing with grief. Certainly time helps a lot. And anybody who's lost anyone knows that over the course of time, it becomes a little bit more something you can deal with and a little less painful. But I can tell you, you know, I'm 27 years out from Steve's loss and I don't think about him every single day. I don't bemoan the fact that he's not here. I have moved on in my life. I have my daughters now have kids of their own, so I have grandchildren, and life is really good. But there are still times, and I ran into those even in writing this book, that some of that overwhelming sense of loss came smack back in my face again when I would sit down to write about it. So it's not something, you know, some people that maybe haven't experienced grief or a death of a close friend or a close loved one may not fully get the idea. You don't just get over it.
Right.
The person that you lost, hopefully, was so important and significant in your life, and in my case, in my life and in my kids' lives, that's not something that you get past that. You figure out ways to move forward and to gain things from that, which I do believe we all have gained things, have found some gifts in this loss. But it's one of those things that you just don't, you know, okay, it's day 8 or it's week 7. Now you're done. Move on. It doesn't work that way.
We're talking to Gail Garbarino-Cullen, Her new book is Owning Grief, Widowed Young, How I Discovered Gifts in Loss. It's about the loss of her husband. She's a longtime Milwaukee journalist. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question, maybe an experience of your own to share with us. That's 800-642-1234. Josh joins us now in Marshfield. Josh, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to tell us about Josh?
Well, I was just listening in, and I just wanted to say my experience of grief, especially during the holidays. So what happened like 5 years ago was my grandma, who was 95 at the time, was dying and just letting go. And fortunately, we did have this experience of her passing during Christmas. And I think I was really just mad during that time because no one told me beforehand when I was going home for Christmas. And unfortunately, she died. And I just felt really just devastated, even though I knew it was her time to go and she was kind of allowing us to have that time to go. I was just mad afterwards just because no one was honest. And I kind of had to process my own grief for it and just anger towards it. And kind of during this whole COVID, I kind of thanked that experience because it kind of inoculated me into seeing a lot of people, you know, unfortunately dying from COVID. And I just want to say it's hard.
Josh, I hear you, and I'm sorry for that difficult experience. That said, Gail, you talk about the complicated emotions that come along with guilt, and you have a reading for us related to Josh was talking about anger there, and this is what you're talking about here. Can you share that with us?
Absolutely, Josh. You're right on the money. Anger is certainly one of those emotions that you go through and that you keep going through periodically after the loss of someone. And this is part of what I wrote in my book. Exhausted by the day, the dinner hour, and the rituals of getting four kids tucked into bed, appropriate stories read, and nighttime prayers said, I wanted nothing more than to sit down and put my feet up. And then the snow. As I trudged outdoors at nearly 10 p.m. to clear the sidewalk and the ever-so-long driveway by hand for the umpteenth time, I was angry. You should be here doing this, I shouted into the winter sky, not caring if any neighbor was witnessing this slightly crazed woman in her snow-filled driveway. This is your job, not mine. Tears streamed down my cheeks with each shovelful of the heavy, cold annoyance. Steve had always taken care of the outdoor chores that came with owning a house. I handled so much of what needed to happen inside that it seemed a good working compromise. How dare he leave me and dump this wet, sloppy, heavy burden on me? Of course, it wasn't really about the snow. It was yet another slap in the face, as if I needed it, reminding me that the house, the kids, the financial worries, everything sat squarely in my lap. Steve was not there to shoulder any of the myriad responsibilities. The one who for 17 years had been by my side was noticeably, prominently, permanently, awfully absent. He hadn't asked for this, but neither had I.
And that, I love that you included that in the book, because I think people, as in the way they talk about grief, they might not want to talk about that the anger and the other difficult emotions that they might not be willing to admit. Why was that important for you to share?
Well, you know, it does seem, how can you blame the person who's gone? They didn't do anything. It's not their fault. But it's just a very natural emotion that you encounter. And in fact, it was interesting when I sat down to actually physically write this. You know, a lot of memoirs tend to be, you know, I was born here, I grew up here, I was raised here, I did, you know, kind of very chronological. And I sat down to write this, and it was like, I can't write this chronologically. It doesn't make sense because I would be I was very angry at the beginning, but there were many other moments along the way, and there have been along the way, you know, that I was angry again. And these emotions would kind of ride this wave, this roller coaster. It's like, how do I write about this? And so that's why I decided to write the book more from an emotional perspective. Anger is certainly a huge part of grief, anxiety, fear. A lot of those things keep cropping back up again and again and again. And so to write them and at more about how the emotion of that moment was, and or those moments, and then relate to how I overcame them, how I moved past them in that moment, and then, you know, would find them jumping up and hitting me in the face again here and there.
We're talking to longtime Milwaukee reporter Gail Garbarino-Cullen about her memoir, Owning Grief, Widowed Young, How I Discovered Gifts in Loss. You can join in if you have a question for Gail about dealing with grief, maybe an experience to share. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with longtime Milwaukee reporter Gail Garbarino-Cullen about her memoir. It's called Owning Grief, Widowed Young, How I Discovered Gifts in Loss. Go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, I understand you have a story to share with us.
Yes, I lost my little boy Matthew when he was about 6 and a half, and it was sudden. And one of the things that I experienced was that I had built this whole network of support people around me, his teachers, his doctors, he had some disabilities. And when he died, I felt like I lost all that support. All those people that had helped me get through parenting him. And one of the things that helped me the most, besides having a good therapist, was going to Compassionate Friends, a support group for people who had a child die.
Okay, I'm so sorry for that loss, and thank you for being willing to share that with us. Gail, some common themes there, finding that kind of support, therapy as needed. Can you talk about your own experiences?
Well, and Kay, you're right on the money as far as, you know, a lot of people have a hard time dealing with grief, or they think that, okay, well, the person's passed, so now I don't need to be a part of the survivor's life anymore. And that is so hard. And I certainly experienced that. My kids experienced that too. There were certain friends that had been so close to us, and after my husband passed away, they disappeared. And I think some of that is people not knowing how to cope with the grief, not knowing, you know, if the physical sight of you as the survivor can trigger their own loss, their own sadness about the loss of your son in this case, or my husband in my case, that they'd prefer to just cut off that relationship and not go there. And that's really, really challenging. But I think you were wise to find other ways to go about that. I always thought of myself, even before my husband passed away, as sort of, you know, this strong mother that could just take on the world and handle anything. And then this happened to me, and it was clear that I couldn't do it alone. And finding the people that were really, truly good friends, even some new friends that I didn't know that I would run into. And that's what you're talking about with the grief group that you attended. Finding those people and reaching out to people that you do know who have stood by you and will stand by you. That's such a huge, huge part of coping with the grief and dealing with the loss and moving forward. Moving past, moving forward in your life.
Okay, thanks again for sharing that story. I wanted to ask you, Gail, about the best ways for people to help. There's some people who seem just really good and they know what to do. And there's people, I'll admit, like me, who might say something vague like, let me know if I can help, which I think is probably not very helpful. How can we move somebody like me into that better category?
Well, I think that's fair, and that, you know, grief is such a hard thing to deal with. It's so hard. Death is a hard thing to deal with, and so it's hard to know when you go to a funeral and there's the grieving widow or mother or father or whoever, and to go up to them and know, what do you say? What could possibly be helpful? And you don't want to not say something. It's just really a predicament, and I think one of the, for me personally, one of the things that I found the most helpful was when people would not be afraid to talk to me, not be afraid to talk about my husband, maybe tell even a funny story, a funny memory that they had of him, something that was meaningful to me to hear, and that they shared that with me. And that was so much better than just a generic, let me know how I can help, see ya. You know? And I think that that's really that really helps a lot. And to not be afraid of causing the person who's grieving to cry. Crying is absolutely normal, absolutely a part of grief. It's not a bad thing. And so, yeah, you might bring some tears to my eyes when you mention some fun or funny story of Steve that I didn't know. But what a wonderful joy that is for me to hear that story. A lot of people came forward after Steve died and wrote or told me personally of some anecdotes, some ways that he had touched their lives, that many of which I had never known about. And that was a wonderful gift that they shared with me. And I think if we can all, in trying to help others with their grief, try to even find just a single little moment of what that person meant to you and share that with the family that's grieving, I think that can go a long way toward helping them with their loss.
Talking to Gail Garbarino-Cullen. Her new book is Owning Grief, Widowed Young, How I Discovered Gifts in Loss. We'll go now to Wendy with us in Oconomowoc. Wendy, hi.
Hello. My husband died after
almost. Oh, I'm sorry, Wendy. We've got a bad connection. I'm so sorry. Thank you for being willing to share your story, though. We'll go to John in Mason. John, hi.
Oh. I'm just calling to say I saw a meme that explains how the feeling of loss changes over time. It was a meme with three jars, a small, medium, and large, and the jars represented us. The grief inside the jars stayed the same. It didn't diminish at all, but we changed. We adapted and we grew around the grief.
John, thank you so much. And John sets up what I was going to ask to talk to you about in the last few minutes, Gail, so very well. You talk about post-traumatic growth in the book, which I think John really hit the nail on the head. Can you talk about that a little?
Absolutely. And I had never heard that term before. I was well into writing the book when I stumbled upon some article on the internet about post-traumatic growth. And as I was reading what that was, it was like, oh my goodness, this is what I'm writing about. I thought people would think I was slightly off my rocker when I wrote that there were gifts in loss. There were positive things that came out of losing my husband. That doesn't mean that I'm glad he's gone, but there certainly have been some wonderful gifts that have resulted from that, including my growth in my own career, my relationship with my daughters. We have an annual run and walk that we host every year to support cardiac research in my husband's memory. A lot of really positive, growing things that have resulted from Steve's death. And I think, John, you're right on the money. That meme is perfect because, yeah, your grief doesn't go away. It doesn't diminish. But you grow so much that you become better able, better equipped to handle it and to live with it and to blossom even as a result.
John, thanks a lot for the call. Gail, can you take a couple minutes to speak to, I think, your main intended audience, someone out there who's maybe dealing with a loss, maybe very recent, maybe in the last couple of years. Share something a little more from your experience that might help them out.
You know, it's so hard in the moment, and that could be, you know, the month or the weeks or the first year or whatever surrounding the death of someone that we love. It's so hard to think beyond that there is more after that there is something to hope for. But I can tell you from my own experience, if you can open yourself up to the support of others and to the willingness to find some things that maybe are not the worst thing about this. As I mentioned briefly, my relationship with my daughters, I think they are all so strong and so unwilling to sweat the small stuff in so many ways. And I think that's a gift from having lived without their dad. And that sounds a little weird, but I think if you are able and at least open to seeing when there maybe is something positive that can come from this, that there really is the ability to find a greater you around that grief that will make you a more whole person again, and that you can grow and develop and really own the grief.
And I love, I'm looking at the website, CullenRun.com, for that Steve Cullen Healthy Heart Club run/walk funds research at the Medical College of Wisconsin. A great tribute. Can you encourage people to participate?
Absolutely. Come on out. This is our 27th year. Steve's been gone for 27 years. And to date, we've raised over $600,000 for heart research. You know, it's a wonderful thing that we have been able to come up with a way to memorialize Steve, but also do something really good with the money. The research that we fund is truly groundbreaking. And it's an incredible tribute to him, and I think to my girls and my family, that we put this on every year and that literally hundreds of people come out and join us and help support the cause.
Gail, thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely, Rob. Thank you so much for having me.
That's Gail Garbarino Cullen, longtime TV and radio reporter in Milwaukee. Her new book is Owning Grief, Widowed Young, How I Discovered Gifts in Loss. That website again, CullenRun.com. Tomorrow on Central Time, Food Friday, inspiration from Native American cooking traditions, that and more. Tomorrow on Central Time.